TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Naomi Klein, This Changes Everything. On her website, Naomi Klein says, "Forget everything you think you know about global warming. The really inconvenient truth is that it's not about carbon, it's about capitalism. The convenient truth is that we can seize this existential crisis to transform our failed economic system and build something radically better." In a small town in Northern California, a grassroots coalition almost filled the 1,000-people capacity Veterans Building to hear Naomi Klein speak about her 2014 book, This Changes Everything. Here she is.
I'm so happy to be here tonight. I want to thank the North Bay Organizing Project for organizing the hell out of this evening and bringing together just the most spectacular coalition of groups. I chose the title, This Changes Everything, because I think it starts the conversation in the right place. And by that I mean that it starts the conversation with the premise that when it comes to climate change, there are no non-radical options left on the table. That's what it means to talk about climate change in 2014. If we stay on the road we're on, if we continue with what is called business as usual, then we will face radical changes to our physical world. That's what our climate scientists tell us. That's what some of the most conservative institutions in the world, like the World Bank, like the International Energy Agency, like PricewaterhouseCoopers tells us. They say that business as usual leads us to 4 to 6 degrees Celsius of warming. That's pretty radical, because we've only warmed climate from post-industrial levels by 0.7 degrees Celsius so far, and you in California are certainly feeling the effects of that already. So 4 degrees, you know, all the climate models break down, but we know we're talking about entire countries disappearing beneath the waves, major cities disappearing as well, cities like London, San Francisco. We know we're talking about massive crop failure. So all we have to do to get to that very frightening place is nothing. We just have to keep doing what we're already doing, which is fueling our economies with fossil fuels, our agricultural system with fossil fuels. And as we do this, we don't just do the same thing. We double down on the dirtiest, highest risk fossil fuels, because the easy to get stuff is depleted. So that means oil from the tar sands in my country, in Alberta. That means natural gas from fracking with the use of water and the high methane emissions. It means drilling in the Arctic. It means more deep water drilling. So that's business as usual. Now, the good news is that it is not too late to give ourselves a solid chance of avoiding those catastrophic scenarios. It is still possible to keep warming below 2 degrees, which is the level that our governments agreed to when they went to Copenhagen in 2009 and decided that warming of 2 degrees Celsius, anything beyond that, was too dangerous. It's not too late to do that, but the catch is that if we want to do that, that involves radical changes to our political and economic system. So in the book, I talk about why it is that we have failed so spectacularly to rise to this challenge, to rise to this crisis. And there are all kinds of theories that have been floated on this. We sometimes hear, well, it's human nature. You know, if there is a direct threat, we'll respond to it, but not if there's a threat far off in the future. But I feel like that rationale is really falling apart as climate change comes knocking on our doors. I mean, this is not an abstract threat in California. It wasn't an abstract threat when Hurricane Sandy hit New York City and Wall Street itself was flooded. And we have risen in the face of threats that weren't knocking on our door before. I mean, this country did so during World War II, even though it wasn't immediately threatened. It embraced a transformative economic program that changed its factories from producing automobiles to producing fighter jets practically overnight. So it is possible to change very rapidly, but we haven't done so in the face of this threat. The other thing we're told is that, well, it's just so complicated for all of these governments to come together and agree on anything, but that also falls apart because our governments have come together and agreed on lots of things. In this period that we've been failing to deal with climate change, wrote an incredibly elaborate, legally binding trade system. The World Trade Organization was launched in the early 1990s. So the argument I make in the book is that this has to do with epic bad timing, epic historical bad timing, by which I mean that climate change as a crisis landed on our laps at the worst possible moment in human evolution. And that moment was 1988. 1988 was the year that James Hansen testified before Congress and said that he now had a high degree of certainty that there was a connection between emissions and warming. So what else was happening in this period? Well, 1988 was the year that Canada and the US signed the first big free trade agreement that would eventually be extended into NAFTA, which became the prototype for dozens of similar trade deals, and they're still coming at us fast and furious. 1 year later, 1989, was the year that the Berlin Wall collapsed and history was declared over. It was the triumphant moment for a brand of unfettered capitalism that Joseph Stiglitz has called market fundamentalism. And this is really the subject of my last book, of the Shock Doctrine, of how that radical strain of capitalism came to dominate the world on the backs of shocks, right? But the problem when it comes to climate change is that if we look at the pillars of this ideological project, and we're all very familiar with them, it's privatization, it's deregulation, it's cuts to government spending, to social spending, in order to pay for tax cuts for the elites, for corporations. This is the ideology that told us, as Thatcher put it, that there is no such thing as society, that all we are consumers, that there's something sinister about acting collectively, about planning our economies in any way. That's a problem when it comes to climate change, because the climate change is the very essence of a collective problem. It therefore demands collective solutions, collective action, not just individual consumer ones. So I'm going to talk a little bit more about the specific clashes between that ideological project and what we need to do to confront climate change, because I actually think, in a way, it's really good news, because climate change can be a catalyst for us to take on this ideology, which is harming us on so many other fronts. But before I do that, and this is very related, I want to talk a little bit about something that we don't talk nearly enough about when we talk about climate, and that's power. And by power, I don't mean electricity. I mean political power. On one side of this debate, we have some very, very, very motivated forces. We have fossil fuel companies who, if we accept the cutting-edge research coming out of the Carbon Tracker Institute, this is the research that Bill McKibben popularized in his Rolling Stone piece, Do the Math. If we want to hold on to that 50-50 chance of keeping temperatures below 2 degrees warming, then fossil fuel companies need to keep 80% of their proven fossil fuel reserves in the ground, okay? Now, they really, really, really want to dig them up because it's extremely profitable for them to dig them up, because they're already counting those reserves on their balance sheets. And these are the most profitable companies, as Bill says, in the history of money. So they don't want climate action, because climate action spells the end of their business model. And so they fight. And they fight like they mean it. And they fight with passion. They fight with creativity. So that's what we've got on one side of this issue. On the other side of this issue, there was actually just a Gallup poll that came out today asking people to rank their political priorities on a list. And this year, like every year, people ranked climate change last on the list. And this is the essential problem. You've got, on the one side, very passionate people who don't want action, and on the other side, you have a lot of liberals who say they care about climate change, but not that much. And they don't send a message to politicians that there are real political costs for ignoring this problem. So any serious plan to address the climate crisis needs a credible strategy for dealing with this massive imbalance of forces, this urgency gap. It can't just be, and this is what so much of what passes for climate debate seems to be, this sort of wonky discussion about what one's favorite, you know, mechanism. Do you favor a carbon tax or cap and trade, or, you know, or just focused on the technologies, right? You know, what's better? Is it wind or solar or nuclear? But the point is that the discussion can't simply be about what our technocratic preferences are. It has to be about the politics of this, the power politics of this. How we're going to build a counter power to the power of the fossil fuel lobby and break this impasse. Now, as far as I know, the only way you can win a battle against a small group of wealthy and powerful interests with a huge amount to lose is by building a movement made up of massive numbers of people with a huge amount to gain. And that is precisely what a response to climate change that is grounded in economic and racial justice can offer, precisely by putting economic transformation and social transformation at the center of our response to climate change. So I want to talk a little bit about specifically what these clashes are between free market ideology and what it could mean to building a grand coalition in response to this crisis. And a lot of it is really obvious, right? I mean, if we're talking about responding to climate change and getting our emissions down as quickly as we need to, and what scientists tell us now is that we need, if we want to stay within our carbon budget, we need to be cutting our emissions by 8 to 10% a year. That is massive. That is what Michael Mann describes as the procrastination penalty, right? If you let your emissions rise by 61%, which is what we've done since 1990, then the sort of gentle market mechanisms that they were talking about back in the 90s no longer apply. You need something much, much more robust. And so we need to invest massively in the public sphere in transitioning our economies away from fossil fuels, and that means rolling out renewable energy very aggressively. It also means reducing demand for energy through projects like affordable mass public transit, something that is desperately needed in this state. And it means changing our agricultural system so that it is much less reliant on fossil fuels at every level. So we need that kind of public investment, but we also need a public investment that's going to protect us from the heavy weather that we've already locked in. We're no longer talking about acting to prevent climate change. We're talking about acting to prevent catastrophic climate change. We're already locked in to pretty serious climate change, and we're already seeing the effects, and we're already seeing again and again the lethal combination of heavy weather and weak infrastructure, right? You know, I end the shock doctrine with a chapter on Katrina, on Hurricane Katrina, because it is such a powerful example of this toxic combination. The superstorm hits those neglected levees after warning after warning that they needed to be repaired, and they weren't repaired, and the levees break. And then the world watches in horror as FEMA fails to find New Orleans for 5 days, as the state completely fails to respond to the pressing need for an evacuation plan, for emergency relief. People were utterly abandoned in the Superdome, on their rooftops. If you had money, you got in your car, you drove out, you checked in a hotel, you called your insurance broker. But if you needed a state to actually be responsible, you were out of luck. And it was a wake-up call. In the shock doctrine, I quote Jonah Goldberg, you know, very right-wing columnist, saying, you know, when there's a crisis, you want big government to ride to the rescue, right? Even the most right-wing columnists were going, oh, you know that government we've been attacking for the past 30 years? We could really use it now. And we saw more of these collisions when Hurricane Sandy hit New York City, that dichotomy between what it meant to experience a disaster like this if you had wealth and means versus if you were living in public housing, in the Rockaways, in other low-income neighborhoods. People were once again just abandoned. And the weak infrastructure, the fact that public housing has been so systematically neglected, getting ready for a wave of gentrification, meant that these buildings were not in any way ready for the storm. The lights in New York City came back within days, but the lights in the public housing projects, they stayed dark for weeks on end. So the point is that if we take this crisis seriously, if we stop looking away, and so many of us are afraid of actually looking at the science because it is so horrifying and really absorbing it, this is the best argument we've ever had for fighting for the kind of public services we need and deserve. And I know that there are people in this room who have been fighting against cutbacks for decades in education, in healthcare. And this, the climate crisis has the potential to supercharge all of these movements, to infuse them with existential urgency. And it's not just about delivering those services that improve people's lives, but it's also about the potential for creating huge numbers of well-paying, unionized jobs. And you know, there's a really active movement in this area for affordable public transit. And there are movements across the country, but it's really striking that these don't get recognized as climate solutions. When people are fighting for affordable transit, even if they never use the word climate, they are fighting for climate solutions. They're also fighting for economic justice, they're fighting for racial justice, but they need to be recognized as also being part of a climate justice movement. So when we fight to protect and rebuild the public sector, we always hear the same thing, right? There's no money. Yeah, good idea, but we're broke. And our governments are always broke. They've been telling us this for a long time, but they are particularly broke at the moment because most of those governments, your government certainly, spent a whole lot of money bailing out the banks recently. And because this was done on such a spectacular scale, there's simply no way for us to do the same for the fossil fuel companies and the big agribusiness companies that are at the heart of the climate crisis. We cannot let them pocket their huge profits while taking on the burden of cleaning up their mess. So the response to the crisis of climate change, unlike the financial crisis, must be guided by justice. And that means polluter pays. And there are all kinds of ways that this can be done. It can be done by higher royalty rates. It can be done by increasing taxes, and not just on the fossil fuel companies, but on all the super consumers who are emitting far more than their share. It can be done through financial transaction taxes. It can be done by nationalizing energy companies if they refuse to play along. But we cannot accept climate policies that pass the bill onto working and unemployed people who are already struggling to pay their heating bills and pay for transportation. I actually think that this may be one of the most important side effects of the growing fossil fuel divestment movement. I mean, this is a movement that's been growing very, very quickly. It's chalking up some pretty important victories. Stanford University announced that it was divesting its huge endowment from coal. Just last week, Edinburgh University became the first university in Europe to announce that it was divesting from fossil fuels. Many, many faith organizations are stepping up to this challenge. Many cities are divesting from fossil fuels. And then something quite shocking happened last month, which was that the day before the UN Climate Summit in New York took place, some members of the Rockefeller family announced that they were divesting one of their foundations, the Rockefeller Brothers Foundations, from fossil fuels. That when Valerie Rockefeller Wayne explained in an interview why this was, she said, "Our family has a special responsibility because we made our money in oil to use that wealth to stop climate change." And she's right. And what she was articulating in a nutshell was the polluter pays principle. And that is the idea that when you have a commercial activity that creates hefty public health and environmental damage, the polluters must shoulder a significant share of the costs of repair. And this is the principle that eventually forced the tobacco companies to foot the bill for paying for campaigns to help people quit smoking and pay for the huge healthcare costs associated with smoking. This is a principle that's long been enshrined in environmental law that has been steadily eroded and abandoned and has not been applied to the way we're responding to the climate crisis. Now, of course, this can't just be done voluntarily out of the goodwill of, you know, very wealthy heirs to oil dynasties, because Standard Oil, the company that John D. Rockefeller founded, was broken up, as we know, and it became, among other companies, ExxonMobil. ExxonMobil is the most profitable company in the world. It made $45 billion in profits. So this is where I think divestment is really important, because it's making the argument that these profits are morally illegitimate, and that's why universities should sell their shares. That's why churches should sell their shares. That's not enough. It's not enough to publicly disassociate ourselves from these profits. The public needs to lay claim to these profits to respond to this crisis. So, we need to fight austerity. We need to go after some of the money stuck at the top of our economy, but we need to do more than that. We also need to go after the logic of privatization, which is one of the key pillars of the neoliberal era. And this is already happening as communities take climate change seriously. Now, many of us have heard a lot about the energy transition that's going on in Germany, and it's really important for Americans to pay attention to, because this is, you know, an industrialized economy, an advanced industrialized economy that I think a lot of people here can relate to. And Germany, under pressure from the anti-nuclear movement, which is extremely strong in Germany, and the climate movement, has gone, in a very short period, gone from having 6% of its electricity provided by renewable energy to now having 25% of its electricity provided by renewable energy, much of it wind and solar, much of it decentralized, community-controlled, community-owned. A part of the story that we rarely hear is that this is only happening because in hundreds of cities and towns, huge cities like Hamburg and very small towns, citizens are voting to take back control over their electricity grids from the private players that put them over. And they're doing this because the private companies aren't interested in being part of the energy transition, and it's not as profitable as powering from coal, and so they're too slow, they're not responding, and people are taking it into their hands. And this is starting to happen in the United States as well. In Boulder, Colorado, there's been a local power movement where they've won two referendums, despite being outspent by 10-1 in the first referendum by the private energy company, voted to take back control over their electricity grid so that they could move to renewable energy. And the Boulder case is really interesting. I talk about it in the book. What's interesting to me is that that did not start in any ways being ideologically opposed to privatization. It was actually a group of young people who, you know, Boulder, right? It's Boulder. They bike, they wear fleece, they do all the good things, and they were like, wait a minute, our electricity is coming from coal. This doesn't make sense. So they went to their private energy provider and they said, you know, we'd like to switch to renewable energy. And they realized that this was not going to happen unless they took control over their energy grid. So we have our work cut out for us. Now, I've been getting a little pushback on the book, particularly the subtitle of the book, Capitalism versus the Climate. My friends in the environmental movement, you know, some of them take me aside and they say, you know, Naomi, climate was already big enough. Did you have to make it about capitalism? This was already kind of a heavy lift. Now, I understand their concern, but I actually think that telling the truth about the connection between unfettered capitalism and climate change makes it a lighter lift. Here's what we need to remember. It's not like we're talking about an economy that is working beautifully except for the small matter of rising sea levels. We're talking about allowing sea levels to rise in the name of protecting an economic system that is failing the vast majority of people on this planet and in this country with or without climate change. has already sacrificed a great many people's job security, their homes, their right to good public education, to decent health care, and now that same system is making it clear it is willing to sacrifice the stability of the planet's life support systems. We simply can't let them. Naming the system of unfettered greed as a problem makes climate a lighter lift. Because while a lot of people aren't so sure that climate change is their number one priority, a majority of them know all too well that this economy is not working for them. This gives us the chance to draw connections between so many issues that we have been working on, whether it's free trade, whether it's the anti-war movement. I mean, there's certainly a connection to climate there, not just because the DoD is the single biggest customer of fossil fuels, but because so many wars are waged in order to access them. And of course, we know that none of this is going to happen unless we deal with the elephant in the room, which is the obscene role that corporate money plays in the political process. The question is, can climate change, because it affects us all, bring us together to fight in common cause? But the thing about a crisis this big, this all-encompassing, is that it changes everything. It changes what we can do, what we can hope for, what we can demand from ourselves and our leaders. It means there's a whole lot of stuff we've been told is inevitable that simply cannot stand. And it means there's a whole lot of stuff we've been told is impossible that has to start happening right away. Can we pull it off? All I know is that nothing is inevitable. Nothing except that climate change changes everything. And for a very brief time, the nature of that change is still up to us. Thank you.
Naomi Klein, author of This Changes Everything, receiving a standing ovation in the huge auditorium of the Santa Rosa, California Veterans Building. The date, October 17, 2014. The North Bay Organizing Project that almost filled the hall is a coalition of 18 labor, immigrant rights, faith-based, union, living wage, education, and environmental organizations. The Canadian writer Naomi Klein first received international attention with her book No Logo, that went on to become an international bestseller, and The Shock Doctrine, a critical analysis of the history of neoliberal economics. For the Q&A session and more information on everybody involved, come back when TUC Radio returns. You can hear this program again on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation on TUC's website keeps this program on the air. That's tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gladden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.